It's Charlotte Talks, a listener-funded 90.7, WFAE and 90.3, WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, a special two-hour Charlotte Talks public conversation, Building Trust. Where does Charlotte go from here? We come to you from a nearly full house at Spirit Square's McGlohan Theater, where later in the program we'll hear from as many audience members as we can and also look ahead to what we can learn from what happened here 2 weeks ago today. And to help us figure out how we got to where we are today as a community, we're going to look back at some Charlotte history. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, Charlotte has a history. Brenda Tyndall is here to help us do that. She is the historian at the Levine Museum of the New South. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Susan McCarter is associate professor in the School of Social Work at UNC Charlotte and head of Race Matters for Juvenile Justice. Welcome back to the program to you.
Thank you, Mike.
And James Ferguson is founding partner and president of Ferguson Chambers and Sumter Law Firm and a civil rights pioneer here in Charlotte. Good to see you again as well.
Thank you.
Let's begin with you, Mr. Ferguson, because you've been a member of this community for nearly forever. He grew up in Asheville, so we have to cut him a break a little bit. But you worked on civil rights at the height of the movement. How many of the problems that we thought we had solved during that era were really solved?
Not many, if any. People treat what happened in recent weeks as though that's something new, but it really isn't something new. And people talk about the Charlotte way. People talk about the Charlotte way being coming together and talking and resolving our problems. But just to give you a quick overview of my vision of that, even before I came to Charlotte, I saw violence in Charlotte. I remember when a young high school girl named Dorothy Counts tried to go to a school that was white back in 1957. She was hounded. She was called every name under the sun except the child of God. There were adults there throwing rocks and bottles at her. That was a violent reaction to a child going to a school that the Supreme Court had said she should go to. A few years later, if I could a few years later, 2 years before I came to Charlotte, I came in 67. Well, in 1965, my former partner, Julius Chambers, had his house bombed. Reggie Hawkins had his house bombed. Fred Alexander, his brother, Kelly Alexander, all of whom were African-American leaders in Charlotte, had their homes bombed because they were there pushing for the rights of African-Americans to participate in the society. And if I fast forward to 1996 or 7, we come almost exactly to where we are now. Police shootings and killings of African Americans was not new then. There were two African American women, as I recall it, unarmed, who were killed while they sat in their automobiles. There was a young man, James Willie Cooper, who was in his automobile with his six-year-old daughter in the back seat. He was shot, unarmed. Charlotte almost came apart at the seams then. There were protests then. We didn't have quite the same show of violence that we had then, but people were angry because they knew that something was not right. So Charlotte has a history of violence, just like all other communities in America, and particularly in the South, have a history of violence when society begins change.
But we always like to say we're not Birmingham and we're not Selma, and we're the city that made desegregation work. Just an illusion?
Very much so. We're not Birmingham, we're Charlotte. In Birmingham, four little girls were bombed in 1963. I'm telling you that in 1965, four homes where there were little girls were bombed. They just didn't get killed as they did in Birmingham, but it was bombing. It was Charlotte. It was the white community's response to a change in their way of life. Now, I don't mean to say that everything that happened was violent. The school desegregation process here was not violent in the same sense. There were no bombs thrown, there were no shots fired, but there was fierce and intense resistance to school desegregation in Charlotte. Judge McMillan issued more than 20 orders telling the school board to do what he first told them to do, desegregate your schools. They wouldn't do it. The school board fought it. Eventually, when they got to the point where the judge said, well, you got to do it, and you got to do it the way I'm telling you, since you wouldn't do it the way you could have yourselves, then they reluctantly desegregated the schools and amazingly claimed Charlotte as being the premier school system in the country for desegregation. So we have a way of revising and sanitizing our history. We have problems like everybody else do. We have problems right now.
We have a lot of young people who don't know that history. They just don't know it, or they don't fully appreciate what people like you went through to get where we are today, even though we still have problems. I think life is better for most people. I think you're better at that than I am. But you told an interviewer once that when you grew up in the days of full segregation, what you referred to as full apartheid, that African Americans were always aware of their race. You said if you were black, you couldn't escape it, and it didn't matter whether you were in the classroom or whether you were in a social setting. Wherever you were, it was just a stark fact of life that you had to deal with, because most everything was defined by race. Still true today in the black community?
I didn't even remember I said that, but I'm glad I did. And yes, in the life we live now, I'm not going to say that it's like it was in 1942 when I was born into Jim Crow in Asheville, but we're still very much defined by race. And you look at any aspect of our society, and you see it there. Right. And you still see African Americans on the bottom, still defined by race. It's been that way ever since we came over on the slave ship. And it's continued that way. And we've seen violence. We've known violence. We've known degradation. We've known terrorism. We've known it all. And still, as Maya Angelou says, we rise.
This is radio, so people can't tell that as we sit on the stage in a darkened theater, that many of the reactions that you're hearing are coming, I believe, not all, but many, are coming from African Americans. So there is a definite it's not true? Well, as I say, the lights are out and you all look the same in the dark. So
well, it's dark out there. They all look like African Americans.
But now, but Susan, who our radio audience cannot tell, is white. And you've been nodding fairly vigorously in recognition of all this, and you have been also working on racial equality for a very long time, and many people think we have a handle on this. We don't.
No, I loved that Mr. Ferguson was able to explain when we look at statistics, we always see that disparity or that disproportionality by race and ethnicity. When I first began the work that I do, it was around adolescent risk and resiliency, and I really focused on young people of color and their overrepresentation in the juvenile justice system. But what I quickly learned, thanks to some work here in Charlotte through Race Matters for Juvenile Justice, is that that separation that Mr. Ferguson so eloquently described is not isolated just in the criminal justice system. It's in our schools, it's in healthcare, it's in child welfare, it's in every system that we examine, and it always shows what Mr. Ferguson described. We see that although blacks and whites use marijuana at about the same rate, in fact, some studies would suggest whites use it a little bit more often, African Americans are 3.73 times more likely to be arrested for the possession of marijuana. We find in our school systems, despite the fact that school behaviors for what we call mandatorily reported offenses are the same or proportionate by race and ethnicity, we find for discretionary offenses, African Americans are 31 times more likely to have a school discipline action than whites who commit the same offense. Likewise, we see over decades, I mean, Brenda and I were talking earlier this week about, you know, 70s and then 80s and then 90s and then 2000 all the way up until now. We've known that infant mortality rates are vastly disparate by race and ethnicity, and we're not able to do anything about it, or we're not trying hard enough.
That would come as a surprise to a lot of people out there, particularly a lot of white people who think the problem is over and why don't we get on with life? Do you hear that a lot in your work?
We hear that a lot. We hear that we need race-neutral policies versus race-focused policy. You know, in the writings and the research that we review at Race Matters, the suggestion is that we have a racialized problem. In order to solve a race-focused problem, we need a race-focused solution. Mm-hmm.
And Brenda.
So one of the ways that I think will help us do that, to your point, Mike, is when we're not examining our own data, when we're not looking at those data disaggregated by race or ethnicity, and when we're not sharing them across systems, when we're just siloed with our own numbers, they look really bad. But what people don't understand is they look the same in all of those other silos. So once we begin sharing and trusting, that's what your show is going to be about today, once we can reveal our own data and our own vulnerability, we can begin to see that this is a collective problem, which I'm hopeful our panelists later will talk about a collective solution.
And Brenda, you're relatively new in town, but you're an historian, so you've done a lot of digging and scratching and searching for things. And this problem is not just one of prejudice, it's one of policy.
Absolutely. I would argue that we have to look at the war on drugs, which really came of age in the 1970s under the Nixon administration. I think we have to look at the stop and frisk policy. We have to look at the third strike policy to understand how African Americans and Latinos have been disproportionately subject to those laws and policies. So absolutely.
What about urban renewal? I mean, the fact that we bulldozed an entire black community, Brooklyn, and the fact that we're now experiencing gentrification in traditionally black neighborhoods, what role does that play, if any, in what we saw last Tuesday, two weeks ago Tuesday?
It contributes to a recession of trust. Because when you don't feel as if you belong or you have a place in a community, you feel displaced. And I think it's really important for people to understand that that race is only one part of our sort of trust conundrum. Part of our issue has everything to do with race, socioeconomic mobility issues, among other matters that shape notions of trust and notions of belonging in this community.
Charlotte was mentioned recently in the New Yorker magazine in an article written by Clint Smith, who is a PhD candidate at Harvard University. And he wrote this: "One cannot disentangle the state-sanctioned school resegregation that poor black students in Charlotte experience from the police killing of a black man waiting for his son to get off the bus from elementary school. The socio-political history of a city in a county with one of the lowest levels of upward mobility among all major metropolises is not a peripheral concern in an analysis of the racial tensions of the moment. It is the foundation of it. The school system... The school system in Charlotte did not resegregate by accident, just as police in Charlotte did not perceive Keith Lamont Scott as a danger by accident. The country we live in is one that we have built to be this way. The cities we live in were built this way. They were court-ordered. They were signed into law. We made these choices, and now we see the consequences." Talk about that.
Absolutely. I think, you know, one of the things that I hear educators say all the time is that we want to produce global citizens. Well, how do you do that when you can't produce local citizens who have a really who have an understanding of the diversity of our community when our schools are 80% one particular race and 20% another race. And so when we did away with busing as a mechanism for desegregating schools, what was also revealed is how segregated we are in terms of neighborhoods, right? So it's easy to revert back to neighborhood schools when you haven't necessarily sought to do away with segregation at the neighborhood level. And so I think we've placed Band-Aids consistently on systemic issues, and now we're dealing with the consequences of that.
James Ferguson, you were in on helping build or take down the blocks of Jim Crow and break down some barriers. When new barriers were put up, was it intentional, or were they unintended consequences, or just bad policy? What happened there?
I think it was a little bit of everything you just said. It was intentional. It had bad consequences, and we still feel the effects of it right now. For example, I mentioned earlier that Charlotte bragged about itself as being the premier desegregated school system in America. And that was in the mid-70s, and then in the 80s it began to change. And then in 1999, the Swan case went back to court. It was called the Capaccione case because one white parent said that his child didn't get into school she wanted to, and therefore she was discriminated against. And very consciously, the judge in that case dismantled the court-ordered school desegregation system. And we said to the court at that time, judge, if you do this, we'll be back resegregated schools in a very short period of time. The judge entered his order, and within 2 years, Charlotte schools were resegregated again. So all the progress that had been made over the past 20 or 30 years was suddenly gone. Now, the worst part of that is that the community did nothing about that. We had a choice at that time to throw up our hands and say, oh, look what the judge did to us. That's terrible. And it's just too bad that our schools are resegregating. Or we could have, as a community, said, to hell with what the judge said. We want to have a diverse community. We want to have desegregated schools. And we're going to find a way to do that. And we could have found a way to do that. We could have done something as simple as economic diversity. That would have given us a lot more desegregation in the schools than we have now.
We'll come back and find out what you think, how we could have achieved economic diversity. We have to take a break. James Ferguson will come back along with Brenda Tindall and Susan McCarter, and then we'll also move on to talk about trust and how trust is being built and how we can continue to build trust during our public conversation on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're coming from the McGlowan Theater at Spirit Square. Charlotte Talks public conversation, building trust. Where does Charlotte go from here? Continues with James Ferguson, an attorney and a civil rights long time. He was the civil rights movement in Charlotte. Or one of the many members, I suppose. Brenda Tindall is an historian with the Levine Museum of the New South, and Susan McCarter, associate professor in the School of Social Work at UNC Charlotte and head of Race Matters for Juvenile Justice. Mr. Ferguson, you just mentioned that one of the things we could have done was to encourage economic diversity. How?
Simply by doing it. And
but
decide,
how?
Well, you would do it by looking at our schools and looking at the economic stratification of our society, and you would require each school to have a certain number of low-income students. And that plays out by integrating people by class. It plays out by integrating people by race. It plays out by bringing diverse groups together all the time. We have to understand that there is nothing about Charlotte that says diversity is going to come about without intention. You got to work on it. You got to think about it. You got to do it.
But why is it?
Everyone would like for it to happen naturally, but it never has, and it never will.
But why is it the city that in the 60s, where leaders in the city got together with African American leaders and went and sat at lunch at restaurants that were closed to blacks, and essentially said, this is my friend and we're having lunch here, try and stop us. Why did that city disappear? Why isn't that same thing going on to encourage the kind of diversity that you're talking about and keeping the schools integrated?
Well, it was done as an event. It was done sort of to avoid protests by getting together and going and saying we're going to do it together. You do that, it's done. Everybody forgets about it. You go forward. But it hasn't continued that way. Blacks and whites don't intermingle that much in Charlotte today. They probably intermingle more in the 60s than they did today, just from my own perspective on it. But my point is that unless someone is committed to bringing about that kind of change and follows through on that commitment, then you have change for a little while, but not for long. It's like what happened when the three unarmed African Americans were killed by police in the mid-90s. Out of that came a group called the Community Building Initiative.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And they've done some things, and they've stayed with it over the years. But after the shootings, and everybody was afraid that the city was going to come apart, after it didn't, things got quiet, and nobody much cared again. And now here we are with what happened a week or so ago.
I think one of the tropes in how we've handled moments of sort of racial tension is that we've done it from a top-down in a top-down manner. And what that does is it evacuates people from participating in deliberating about how they choose to be governed by our leaders. And so I think when we've elided certain people and voices from the conversation, we get these very monolithic ways of dealing with community issues. And so while you pointed to the 1963 Edens, mm-hmm. Which were the mayor as well as African American leaders getting together, who's absent from those kinds of deliberations? And the other question we should ask is who can afford to go to some of the upscale restaurants and hotels for which they were lobbying for, desegregating those spaces? And so even that's a very limited articulation of sort of racial progressivism, if you will.
But we had several decades of integrated schools, and the idea was that if we all got together and got to know each other, then we wouldn't have to do this artificially. It would just happen because we would realize that we have more alike and more in common than we didn't. What happened to that? We have an African-American president. We have had three, by my count, African-American mayors in this town. We've had members of city council. We had an African-American as head of the county government, the county manager. We have had two African-American police chiefs. Why do we still have these problems? Why do we have the problem that you talked about, and that is, Susan, overrepresentation of minority youth and disproportionate minority contacts with police? Why?
Because we of racism.
Exactly. We haven't eradicated
this. But we have a government that's had African American leadership. We have an African American police chief.
But then we're talking about structural issues as well, for which folks are adhering to despite their race, right? And so we have to really think about the pervasive implications of a system of racism.
We heard a lot in the last couple of weeks about implicit bias and institutional racism. How do you recognize that very quickly? Because I'm running out of time.
All you have to do is look at our society. It all stemmed, Mike, from white supremacy, which really developed from slavery and came out to go all through the years. But what we talk about now is white privilege, and we look at what we see. What we're talking about is a society where it is assumed that white people will be on top, and the assumption is correct because of all the things that Susan and Brenda have both talked about, is that when you look at the measures of the quality of life, you find that African Americans and other minorities are on the bottom in housing, in wealth, in schooling, in income. You look at any aspect by which we measure, and we're on the bottom. And Charlotte is on the bottom when it comes to upward mobility, which means if you're born black and poor, that's where you're going
to
remain.
As we head to the middle of the century, at which time white people will become the minority, mm-hmm. will this change?
No.
No?
No.
No.
It won't. Because right now, Mike, white people hold the reins of wealth. They hold the reins of power. And you've heard the saying, no one gives up power willingly. It has to be wrested from them.
So I have
to. Will happen unless it's shared. It needs to be shared.
So that's I have to end this segment, but I also have to ask you, since you've been at this so long, do you ever get tired, and do you feel like you've accomplished something?
We have accomplished a lot. I mean, we're here. We're here and we're talking. That's an accomplishment. But we just haven't tackled the systemic aspects of it. We've allowed ourselves to believe our own PR about that.
James Ferguson, civil rights pioneer. I think that's not inaccurate to say. Brenda Tindall with the Levine Museum of the New South, and Susan McCarter, head of Race Matters for Juvenile Justice. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.